Hello, welcome to This One Time at Summer Camp. I'm comedian Steve Brugere. This is the podcast where we talk to people who have been to camp, worked on camps, and organised the camps. They'll be sharing their stories, their memories, and their mishaps for our enjoyment. Today's guest is British comedian, podcaster, and someone I want to be my friend desperately. It's Richard Herring. He went and worked on a summer camp in the 1980s, and he was kind enough to give up his time to talk to us about it. So here it is. Enjoy, Richard Herring. Hello, Richard. How are you?
Hello, I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
It's all right.
If anyone doesn't know you, comedian, podcaster, author.
Yeah.
But more importantly, former camp counsellor, 1986,
yes.
Redwood Forest, California.
Yes. How do you know so much about me?
I've done some research, okay. Richard. I don't come unprepared to these things. No, I've read your blog. And so you went and worked on a summer camp when you were 18 years old, right?
Yeah, I think I maybe turned 19 when I was there. So I had a year off, it was called, in those days.
Could you paint a brief picture of what 18-year-old Richard was like?
I was a virgin. I was very much a virgin.
Good. I'd to had get a girl that straight away.
I'd had a girlfriend for 2 years, but she was a little younger than me and we were quite an innocent, you know, very inexperienced, really. I'd worked quite hard at school. I was starting to rebel a little bit, I suppose. Certainly once I got to university, I was a bit more rebellious. I'd worked hard for my A-levels. I got to university. There's a great picture of me and my mum at Bristol Airport just before I set off.
I saw it. Yeah.
And you sort of see in both those faces. You see my mum's third child leaving home and her worry at me going up in a plane. And you see me also looking slightly nervous. I think it might have been the first time I was in a plane.
Is that? Oh, wow.
Might have been.
And you were going out to America to try and get rid of the virginity.
I don't know if I had some opportunity and I returned a virgin. Let's get that spoiler in.
Spoiler.
Let's get that spoiler in now, though. I did a couple of things that I hadn't done before.
I mean, it's remarkably similar to my story. I went out there, 18 years old, trying to lose my virginity and also returned. Even more of a virgin.
I mean, I was so scared about it all. I think for various reasons, but I was a very young 18-year-old. I wasn't really keen on drinking tea or coffee. I sort of saw those as adult things.
Okay.
So I remember going around to people's houses with my brother-in-law and them going, and I said, "Can I have a squash?" And they thought I was insane. I remember going on the archaeological dig and having to make a big pot of tea and not really knowing how to do that for loads of people.
Wow, you were a young 18-year-old.
So I was, yeah, I'd sort of been. You know, I loved comedy and I loved being childish, really, and I think I was scared of growing up. So having sex and drinking coffee seemed like things that
the most adult a grown things imaginable.
Up would do. So I was
in that order as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, if you're lucky.
Okay, so you fly out to California.
Yeah, so we flew to New York. We had a night in New York, and then we flew from New York to California.
And this is 1986, so we're going to be testing your memory a bit.
Yeah, we sort of set off quite early. It was a long, long camp. And there were several sessions. I think, again, maybe longer than most, but I think we might have gone across in May.
And each session had different kids.
Yes, yeah, so there was at least four or five, maybe six sessions of a couple of weeks. It was a long, long old time. I was nervous, I think. I was nervous about making friends. I'd been at school. My dad had been my headmaster, had a group of friends, but I kind of was, you know, aware that, you know, other kids viewed me with suspicion. I think it took me a long time to shake that off. I was quite nerdy. And I remember everyone else seemed quite cool.
Was there an element of trying to reinvent yourself when you got to camp? Were you trying to be a different Richard?
I don't know if I was. I suppose a little bit, but I wasn't very successful. But weirdly, I kind of had a very strong first session. Incredibly strong first session.
Talk me through
where
that.
Where I wanted to do drama when I got out there, and there was no drama. So they kind of put me in charge of the jungle gym, which was not a good
like
fit for me, really.
Frames and stuff.
Yeah. But basically, again, it was a camp where nearly all the counselors were European. There was a few Americans, quite cool Americans. And I remember this big guy called Sheldon, who was like an American footballer, I would imagine, but just massive. And then a cool guy who looked a bit like Prince. So there were some American guys there, but there was 30 or 40 Europeans. So I kind of thought I'd be the only European there. Maybe I thought, oh, I'll go and there'll be Americans and I'll seem cool.
Yeah, you got your accent as a benefit.
And so that might be good. But actually, it was nearly all Brits and a few Europeans and a few Americans. But I got put in charge of this jungle gym, and it was a very dilapidated, rundown thing. And they said to me, the jungle gym has never won the best activity in all the time we've been here.
Challenge set
and,
down.
And I thought, well, you know, let's try and get it together. So we kind of came up with, we painted it all, and we came up with names for all the things, like the spider's web for the net and the squirrel jump or whatever. For, you know, so we came up with names for all this stuff, and we put quite a lot of effort into it, and it was quite successful. And then I think I just kind of, we had really nice kids for the first session, and I think maybe more slightly more middle class kids for the first session, and it was kind of quite delightful. And I was a cabin leader, which just meant everyone had their own cabin, and there was a leader of each tribe. There was four tribes.
The tribes.
The age of these kids were probably a little bit older than the ones I was looking at. So, yeah, I was looking at first session, I was looking after maybe 10 to 12-year-olds.
Okay.
And they were really nice kids. I got on with them really well. I got on my cabin really well, and I was doing bits of comedy at the end of the shows, I think. And I sort of became this very popular figure on camp in the first session. And so the Jungle Gym won the best. There was an award ceremony each session, and obviously mainly for the kids, but we won best activity. And I was the best cabin leader of all the cabins.
Voted?
In the whole,
was that a democratic
I think
vote,
it was or? Voted for by the staff, the higher staff, I think.
An accolade to get.
So, yeah, so I started this incredibly strong first session where I'd gone from being very nervous and wouldn't fit in to everyone thinking I was quite funny and doing really well. And then I got promoted to be the cabin leader because people were leaving, you know, councillors were leaving. And then the second session, I was then in charge of the little kids, maybe the 6 to 8 year olds.
Okay.
And they were a fucking nightmare.
And you
and
were
so,
in charge
and of- I was not qualified. I was 18, not qualified to look after loads of kids. They were so annoying. I had like four cabin guys, you know, working for me. I mean, you got moved from the cabin sharing with the kids into your own cabin. So that was quite cool.
That's the benefit of the promotion.
Yeah, so that was really cool and really nice. And we were in this beautiful setting. I mean, it was sort of insane. And so, yeah, but it was awful. It was hell. I couldn't cope with it. I wasn't qualified to cope with it. There's no way they should have put, you know, legally, I don't know if there's any way they should have put me in charge of this.
What was the problem? You just couldn't deal with the behaviour?
They were just awfully behaved kids. And they were, and again, a lot more deprived kids and then much younger kids. So, you know, me coming from Somerset, and these kids were from South Central Los Angeles, I think, you know.
Yeah.
And San Francisco.
A bit more street-wise, isn't
it? I think like the next year, someone said that somebody on our camp, a counsellor, had been shot by one of the kids. I think by an air rifle, but I'm not even sure about that. So there was an element that these kids were suddenly quite rough. I was really out of my depth. I mean, to be honest, I had heard the other stories. The guy had been in charge had been moved on. He was a massive guy, and he would throw kids against cabins and stuff like that. If they were being bad, he would bully them.
Right.
And they were too scared to say anything because it was this genuinely shit brick house kind of sized, terrifying man. And I was this.
But he got fired for that?
No, he didn't get into trouble because we knew about it, but nobody told anyone.
Oh, okay.
About.
So he
just moved on, I think, because he didn't want to do these kids.
Got sick of beating up kids.
Yeah. It was a sort of weird structure where lots of people came back year on year. You got these jackets, green sea, red sea, gold sea, I think, and the kids could get them, the counsellors could get them as well. So some returning counsellors were red seas or gold seas, and everyone was sort of working up their way.
It was a hierarchy.
A little bit of sort of scouts thing. And I sort of then became some, I mean, I can't remember how, but I sort of got into the bad books quite quickly. Me and another guy got really well with called Dan, who went back to his house because he was a Californian, and I wasn't quite sure whether he was joking or not, but he sort of said we were going to be sleeping in the same bed and stuff. And then I wasn't sure whether he'd sort of taken a fancy to me and then I'd misunderstood.
Achieved your aim.
It was, but he went home. I think he might have been let go. But he'd created this thing called the Black Seas and made me a jacket. He was a brilliant artist, made me this jacket. He turned my jacket into a Black Sea jacket. So we were being slightly rebellious. And so it's like taking the piss. So I think I was immediately like marked down a bit for that.
So the first session went so well. You got a bit almost cocky.
Cocky and maybe just, you know, but also just out of my depth.
Yeah.
And the only thing I remember that I did that I nearly got sent home for, which was a bad thing, was there was a kid who was, and it wasn't even one of my kids. He was in the dinner queue and he was trying to push in. And so I said, no, you can't push in. And then he was just kept on trying to push in. And I said, no. So I stood right by him the whole thing so he'd get to his part in the queue. And he was just shouting and making loads and loads of noise and singing in my face and being really annoying. And I'd stood there about 20 minutes. And then he wouldn't shut up and I just slapped him in the face.
Oh.
I didn't think that hard. But he then ran off to tell on me. And they said, it was a wet, you know, you could see your finger marks on his face.
Oh,
and
no.
it was because I was sort of, I was trying to be good and discipline him. And then I kind of just got, because I was 18 myself, got annoyed and behaved badly. And so I was nearly sent home. I then had to take that kid fishing and have a chat and say, please don't tell anyone, you know. And if he told on me, I would have been sent home.
Oh, so it never got to the higher powers?
No, I think, it never got to his parents. So the camp people said, if he goes home and tells his parents what you've done, you'll have to go home.
So fishing was the...
Yeah, and I was a vegetarian at the time, so this was against my principles, but I had to save my own... And I really wanted to sit through because I'd done lots of few things and I'd had to go home, or one of the archaeological digs, one of the diggers had been killed in a car accident, and I kind of felt I couldn't stay there anymore, and I'd gone home and I felt like I hadn't completed lots of things. And so I was really keen to get through all of this long time at this camp and not have to go home.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there was...
And that was successful. The fishing trip was enough to...
Yeah, well, I didn't get in trouble, but obviously by this stage now the hierarchy had lost confidence in me, and I was
I
was demoted back down again to being a cabin leader again, and moved over to a different tribe again. But you know, I think they'd really put me in a position which was not fair. Yeah. Maybe they realised it, and I think they'd been forced into it by just not having the number of people there, you know, to do it. And so I was then, I was then sort of slightly out of favour, except that suddenly, and I think maybe session five, I was made cabin leader again.
You were vindicated.
So I was back, but then the hierarchy didn't like me. I'd taken the mickey out of them all. And again, I think there was like one of the women who seemed like a mature woman who was probably about 25, I think had taken a fancy to me as well, and I hadn't realised, and then I'd been really rude about her in like one of the sketches, and I think a lot of them kind of, you know, because I was...
So who was that, like a division head or something?
Yeah, she was, you know, she was sort of in one of the... There was five or six people who were in charge of it from the boys' club it came from, and I think I hadn't really... She'd invited me back to her, you know, I was so naive. She invited me back to a room and I had to get something, and I'd really just gone back and got the thing, and I wasn't interested. She seemed like ancient to me.
Yeah.
Although then the one girl I did get off with was about 23 or 24.
Great.
And married and divorced, I think, getting divorced.
What a life she's lived in 23 years.
You know, again, she seemed impossibly old, and then we had this night where we got drunk and got together, and I remember her just being... I was wearing Marks and Spencer's pants.
The most British.
And then I think my mum and dad, my mum had bought me, and she couldn't work out what these pants were. You know, she was trying to get into these pants, and I was wearing basically little boys' Marks and Spencer's pants, more or less, you know, that I hadn't chosen myself. So we had there was a little thing that happened there, but it was not my virginity remained intact
due to the M&S pants.
And I think I went after we'd had this little snog and whatever. I went back and I got my one condom that I'd been given, I think, and I was sort of carrying around hoping she would then come and say, let's go and have sex now, which
you know, ready.
Could have happened, and then it all just sudden, that all fizzled out.
Oh.
And I don't know what happened there. But again, my own, you know, stupidity and my own childishness.
So close, though.
I mean, yeah, very close, very close.
Disappointing.
You know, some stuff happened. We got something.
Some progress.
There was loads of stuff, and I can't really remember. There was, you know...
You remember that clearly, don't you?
I do remember that bit. I remember, like, again, I was sort of trying to be friendly to people, you know, and I think, like, because I'd been friendly with, like, some of the little kids, I think some people thought that was weird, which maybe it was, but I like kids. I was a youngest kid, and I'd always liked kids and regretted not having any younger siblings or anything. There was a girl who was 16, who was, I think, the bloke who owned the camp's daughter, and I sort of just tried to be friendly to her, and she was frowning one day, and I said, you know, cheer up, everything will be all right. And she sort of started sending me letters, and I sort of sent her letters back just in a friendly way.
Oh, God.
And then I was taken aside. He said, last year, this girl had a kind of relationship with one of the counsellors when she was 15, and he had to be sent home and all this sort of stuff. I was going, but no, it's not that. I'm just being, you know, I'm just trying to be friendly. Because because I was so naive and so far away from being, that yeah, they would have seen any other 18-year-old and a 16-year-old. And in America... The 18 is the 18 and above is the cutoff, and 18 and 17 is illegal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so 18 and 16 is illegal.
So these are criminal letters.
Yeah. So so if I'd done anything, I could have been sent to prison, even though, you know, most of the fucking kids at the camp were more sexually experienced than I was. So I was getting this bad reputation, and when I finally left
for hitting children,
flirting with children. The flirting with children thing, I can understand why they thought that was what was happening, but it wasn't what was happening. And I just didn't know. I had no belief that anyone would find me sexually attractive anyway. I thought the whole idea was ridiculous. So
who doesn't?
I think I kind of missed a lot of opportunities for for romance at that. And I'd split up with my long-term girlfriend before I went. And I was still sort of pining for all of that, you know. So it was just pathetic and sad.
Welcome back to This One Time at Summer Camp. I'm Steve Bouget. Thank you very much for listening. We'll hear more from Richard Herring shortly. But first, if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the podcast and give us a little rating. This is the last one of Series 1. But hopefully we'll be back with more guests and more stories. I absolutely love doing this podcast. It's so much fun chatting to people. If you've got some stories and memories from working on a camp yourself, I would love to hear from you. Genuinely, however funny or heartbreaking it is, just please give us a message. Tweet me at Steve Bougea. It's Steve and then B-U-G-E-J-A. Buggerja. Give us a little tweet and let us know your story. I'd love to hear from you. And maybe we'll get you on next series as a guest. I couldn't end the series without telling you my favourite story from camp. It's a very specific memory that's etched into my mind forever. A child who will remain nameless. He was maybe 13 years old, and we had a sort of nature park at the camp, and it consisted of a llama and a rabbit. That was the whole nature reserve. And it was quite a low budget camp. And bless him, this kid. He was so excited to see the llama, and he'd never seen a llama before, and neither had I, to be fair. And he was stroking the llama, and he got so excited that he basically punched the llama like square in the face, and the llama like did not see it coming. And this 12-year-old was bigger than me, and the llama went down. Like the llama like took it, like he went down like a sack of, you know, llama. And the poor kid, he didn't know he'd punched it. Really, you know, he had Asperger's, and he was trying to be affectionate to the llama, so we couldn't tell him off. So the kid went off swimming, and the poor llama got fired basically because he was deemed a risk to the kids. So he got punched and then lost his job and got sent back to the animal sanctuary that he came from. So the poor lad, he's probably enjoying his little vacation out in Pennsylvania, and he lost his job for getting punched. So it's a tough summer for the llama. But enough about my memories. Let's get back to Richard Herring.
Away from the romance, do you remember any of the kids?
Yeah, well, I remember this kid. There was this lovely kid, I think it was called Philip. I haven't looked at any of this. There is a yearbook somewhere, so I could have looked some of these up. And he was just such this lovely kid. I think, I can't remember which, it might be one of the kids when I was looking after the really little ones, but I don't think he was. But he was this big, smiley-faced little kid, and he was so friendly, and he was such a nice kid. This is the kid who sent me the money. And I remember I went for my day off, and he was waiting for me at the station and waved at me, you know, waved at me as I came back in. And he was just this really sweet kid, and we really kind of he kind of looked up to me, and I thought he was really nice and a good kid. So I really remember him. So sweet of him to send me like his pocket money.
Yeah.
When these kids had nothing.
He posted it back
posted,
to camp.
Yeah, he posted to camp, and I went to camp and said, look, I've been sent this money. They said, we'll send it back. And so he was nice. There was, I mean, it was weird. There was lots of very rough little kids. There was these kids from just obviously had horrible, horrible backgrounds. So they sort of stick in your mind.
Mm.
I think I remember more all the other counselors and that sort of stuff than actually doing that much of the
actual
job.
Are you still friends with any of them?
There was a girl who I lived with at university, and I haven't spoken to her for ages, though. One guy came who we had sort of been friendly, and he came to a gig. We did
what,
meet
recently?
Up... Pardon?
Recently.
Yeah, yeah. Matthew, he came to see me in Leeds. So I hadn't seen him. Me and him and this other guy went... There were so many weird things that happened. I mean, there was a big fire on the last day.
I read about this in your blog.
So... we all nearly died out there. We were 300 miles away from anywhere, really, or whatever. We're a long way away from the nearest fire, 2 hours, 3 hours away from the nearest fire station. And there was a big party. There was a lot of boozy stuff. You know, that's what I remember. I remember, like, so let's see, the things that I'm suddenly coming back to me. When I was in charge of all the kids, I was in charge of taking kids out on an overnight thing where we'd camp on the hill.
Oh, okay.
And we got to where we were going to camp, just sleep out in sleeping bags. And I said, go and play, stay within 20 yards of here, you can go and explore a little bit, we'll come back. Then someone ran back and said, a load of kids have fallen off a cliff. And so I ran down, and there was a very steep, it wasn't quite a cliff, but it was a very steep thing.
It was a hill.
And yeah, but a like very steep hill, and three or four kids had fallen off this thing, rolled down, one of them had broken a finger. So we had to take them all back. So, yeah, another black mark in my book was that kids had nearly died.
Letting kids play around a cliff edge.
And So that had gone badly. And so then, yeah, the last day of the camp, all the kids had gone, thank God. It rained for the first time all summer, just a little bit overnight, which I think maybe saved our lives.
Wow.
There was a big party in the maintenance crew's hut.
Kids all, have gone home.
Yeah. So it was the last day. Everyone was getting drunk. There was a big party up on the hill. And then we all went to bed. And then I was woken up like in a deep sleep, drunk in sleep, and was shaken awake. I could hear this alarm going off. And he said, it's for real. And I was looking up, and the whole cabin on top of the hill was on fire, and redwood trees were going, and there was, and going up.
Because like, the forest.
Yeah. So literally, you know, if there'd been any wind, if there hadn't been any rain on there, it could have just swept through us. We were trying to work out what we would do if it swept down. We could have gone, try and hide in this water hole. I don't think that would have done us any good. So we basically had to then just try and ship. You know, someone had let a cigarette or whatever go, and this whole house had gone up. That was where all the gas was. What, you know, all the gas canister stuff was. All the
massive. My word!
So I just generally thought we were going to die. We had to help move all this water up. People nearly got run over as we tried to put out these flames and stuff. And we managed to I was loading, you know, water onto this truck. They managed to kind of contain.
There's no professional firefighters.
No. So, you know, we just did it ourselves.
This is just adults trying to put out a fire.
Yeah, and during this, my friends from home had miscalculated the time, and they rang up as they were trying to get to the phone, to knock down the door to get to the phone to ring the fire services. My friends were ringing the camp at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well, your so friends in the UK?
There. Yeah, they're going, is Richard there? They go, get on the line. So these guys, so weirdly that had happened. So, yeah, luckily, just amazingly, no one got killed.
And you did extinguish the fire.
And then the fire brigade arrived and put it out. But it was just like this, you know, I was so convinced I was going to die young anyway as a kid. I was so convinced I'd die before I'd lost my virginity.
Oh, that'd be tragic.
And just like this, yeah, just that you were standing in the middle of this thinking, this is it. There's no way we can survive this.
And you're terrible. Thinking back to that mattress in the Redwood Forest, so thinking why I just hadn't worn the M&S pants.
If I'd had a condom with me, rather than had to go back and get it, what was I thinking? So it was like, you know, it was a big adventure and it was a weird thing, but I just sort of had a quite bad time at camp. And so, you know, and I think I was a very young 18, 19-year-old, I would have, by that stage.
You had your birthday at camp then?
Yeah, so we had the birthday in the camp.
Did you get a big celebration?
I remember being handcuffed to the flagpole and everyone threw stuff, water at me and stuff.
Bullied? You got bullied for your birthday?
I mean, I think that was normal though. It wasn't just, that was the
wasn't
way it
just
was.
You?
No, I think that was sort of what was done. There was this weird guy called Jose who was kind of, you know, maybe a little bit on the spectrum and weird who was... I think I pissed him off. I think I took the piss out of him and pissed him off. But he'd always been at the camp. I kind of heard a story. He won the lottery years later. So I don't know if that's true, but he was a very odd guy who was sort of was the kind of comedy king of the camp. And I think that's why
you threatened him.
I came in and I was, you know, I was quite funny and was doing quite funny shows rather than just weird stuff.
Yeah. But he's had the last laugh already with the lottery win.
He has, yeah, if that's true, if that happened.
Was that your first gig then, when you at camp?
I'd done lots of stuff at school, so it was sort of like, yeah, it was just putting on sketches. In it. I wrote some sketches for it, but I'd written sketches at school, so it was kind of coming out of that. Yeah. And I thought I was going to go to camp. I'd be the only European. I'd teach drama and do kind of, you know, that's what I really wanted to do, and they didn't have a drama department. And so the only time you could drama was at these end-of-term concerts. And then I think I was just too, you know, the stuff was just, I did all the jokes that everyone was doing about, you know, this girl, this woman who fancied anything, having a big bum and stuff like that, you know, it was right. Those sort of things. And
classic stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's, I just pissed off all the people who I should have been nice to.
You were roasting everyone.
Yeah, I was roasting, you know, thinking everyone was getting it was just a joke, but, you know. And yeah, maybe that sort of that boost of confidence of doing well in that first session.
Yeah.
And then it's that Hank Kingsley. Oh, everyone thinks I'm great, so I now can do anything I want. So it was a weird time. And I think, you know, my inexperience and my naivety and my probably arrogance mixed with this, yeah, just being this massive, terrified child, too scared to take drugs, too scared to have sex. I drank beer. That's all I do. So we got wasted a lot.
But it sounds like it was quite a formative summer for you. You sound like you grew up with it.
I did grow up. It was, you know, definitely, I'm glad I did it. I mean, that whole year, I'm really glad I took a year out because it was, you come to university and you have a bit of experience and you know how to cook and, you know, I'd become vegetarian and so you kind of had this life sort of...
Some kids come,
well, you had stories and you'd experienced a bit and I'd been around the world a little bit. Not really compared to today's kids who seem to go really around the world. But yeah, it you know, it was good, and we did all meet up for a bit, a few years, and then you just sort of slightly drift apart.
Oh, your counsellors? you kept in touch with some of them?
Yeah, yeah, the other UK people. So there's a girl I saw for quite a long time who I lived with at university, in the second at university, because she was at the doing occupational therapy in the same city. There was a few people, you know, you'd occasionally write to in the old days when people did letters, but then you just sort of slowly
lose touch.
Yeah.
It's a nice story, though. Please, I mean, it sounds like it was hard. It sounds like a hard
summer.
Yeah,
well, you know, it was life, death, everything, you know, a bit of love, a bit of lust, a bit of fishing with the child I'd smacked. don't hit kids.
Bit of cliff edge fun as well.
Don't have kids falling off. Don't let kids go near cliffs. Don't hit them. I don't think I hit him that hard, but God, you know.
Hard enough, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hitting them at
I
all.
Mean, I wasn't that kind of person, you know. I wasn't violent in any way, so, you know, he just. I think something had snapped in terms of the whole thing. It was too much weight on my shoulders, the whole thing.
Yeah. You've been promoted too quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
You weren't ready.
I wasn't ready for it. And, so I kept that Black Sea thing that the guy, the jacket. I think I've still got it somewhere, actually. It was so that friendship was really nice, but then that guy left, and then I wasn't sure whether he actually fancied me or not. I don't think he did.
I hope he listens to this and gets in touch.
Cindy, who was the daughter, wrote to me for quite a long time afterwards. We were kind of pen pals. It was so pathetic. And she'd essentially got me into this trouble.
Did the camp leader ever know that you were still writing to his daughter?
I think so. I mean, I don't know about that. I mean, I think they realised there was nothing going on.
Nothing sinister.
I mean, I was sort of taken aside by this nice guy who I really liked, who was the cool guy who was one of the hierarchy, and you know, but I think he realized I was just an unusual, and I think especially in America they were all just fucking each other and sucking each other off, and you know, it was all these counselors, and I had no idea.
I was the same. I didn't realize anyone was doing it until the last day. I was like, you've been doing what with him? No way. There was a girl called Lara that was probably my Debbie there, who I loved. Well, I never kissed her, actually, but I loved her very much. And I still look back on it, I think I missed opportunity.
Yeah,
really
well,
missed.
That's
I was
it.
Too
but,
young,
you know,
though.
I'm glad in a lot of ways that, you know, that it took a little time. I definitely wasn't ready. You know, it's sort of weird. People get emotionally ready at different times, don't they? And it's just, I mean, I wish I hadn't been quite so innocent.
Yeah,
I mean, I was practically 20. I was nearly the end of the first year of university before I actually lost my virginity.
Yeah,
and even then, that was a very brief dalliance with someone. And then it was about another year before I had another girlfriend.
Still wearing the M&S pants?
Maybe actually, I don't know. Remember your mum buying your pants when you're 19 or 18?
My mum still buys me them.
Does she?
Yeah. Every Christmas.
Are you still a virgin?
Yeah, still waiting. I'm going to go to camp this summer. Fingers crossed. Overall positive, though.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Richard Herring.
Thank you very much, Richard Herring. That is the final one of the series. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't done already, please make sure you have subscribed and given us a little rating on your podcast app, because that will really help us get a second series, which I would dearly, dearly love to do. I love chatting about summer camps. I've loved doing this podcast, and I think there's loads more stories to hear. There's so many stories out there, and I want to hear your stories, actually. So if you've got a funny story or a heartbreaking story or just anything, really, just please tweet me at Steve Bougea, Bugeja, and let us hear it. I'd love to read them, and I'll actually reply to you, and we can chat about summer camp. But thanks for listening, and see you again.